We have been studying the book of Hebrews for some time. I think this is going to be the 13th or 14th sermon on it. We've discovered above all and above everything else that we should not faint and grow weary as we long for and look for the day when Jesus will come back, but that we must keep focused and trusting in Jesus, because only Jesus can provide that which we need. Is that not right? I want to begin by just sharing something, and some of you may have seen it. My daughter posted something on Facebook last night, but yesterday my wife and I celebrated our 43rd, and I want to thank her for putting up with me for 43. That's a long time to be married, but even though we've been married for 43 years, we still sometimes have some communication issues. And I know that doesn't happen in any of your marriages. Have you ever been confused by something your wife has asked you to do or told you to do, or your spouse? Has that confusion ever led to some tension now and then? Sometimes that tension is because, in my case, I know what I want to say and I know what I want to convey to her. She just doesn't understand what I tried to convey to her. And it probably wasn't most of the time because of what she heard. It was because I didn't convey it well enough, because I already knew what I wanted to convey. You understand what I'm saying? And sometimes she just hears it because of the way she's thinking and doesn't hear the way I conveyed it. And the opposite is true too. And you have to clear those confusions up, because if you don't clear up confusion in relationships, it has some really bad consequences. What will end up happening is that you end up becoming disappointed. And then from disappointment, it becomes resentment. And if you allow it to continue, it becomes bitterness. And if you allow bitterness to continue, there will be rejection and hurt. So clear up the confusion. There's another way that we get confused, and sometimes that's because we just have unspoken expectations of one another, and that's in every relationship. I know what I expect of you, and so when you don't follow through because I know what I expect of you, I get disappointed when you didn't really promise to do what I expected of you in the first place. You understand what I'm trying to say? As the author of Hebrews is writing to Jewish Christians who are thinking, you know, this persecution and this difficult stuff and all these things that we keep facing are causing great pain. Maybe we should just go back and give up on Jesus. I think part of it was because they were confused. They were confused by the message they had heard, and they were confused, more importantly, by the false expectations they had that the moment you accept Jesus, everything's okay. The moment you accept Jesus, as John Ryan will learn, it doesn't mean that everything will, you'll never have any more problems in your life. The moment you accept Jesus doesn't mean that the devil will leave you alone. Far from it. In fact, I've discovered through the years that the times when I struggle the most are the times when God wants to do something in and through me or with me, and the devil just seems to come head on towards me. Anybody else discover that? And so this morning, we are briefly going to look at how the author of Hebrews knows beyond a shadow of a doubt that seven times better equals a better plan, as we've discovered in the first 11 chapters. It's a better plan because it's a plan that that God devised before the world existed, before sin ever came in. And it was a plan that Jesus should come and provide that salvation which we cannot provide for ourselves. But the author of Hebrews knew something else. He knew that the better plan does not avoid suffering and pain. He knew that just because you accept Jesus doesn't mean, piece of cake. No more temptations, no more struggles, no more difficulties, no more persecution, no more hostility from others. They're all going to accept me, love me, and when I witness to them, they'll thank me. He knew that wouldn't be the case. But he knew that there were those who had that false expectation, and because they had the false expectation, they were becoming disappointed. They were becoming resentful. They were becoming bitter, and they were about to give up in trusting Jesus. And so the author of Hebrews gives two commands. And we are given two commands. But he also knows, I want to go back for a second, he also knows that as he goes through this process of reassuring them about the necessity of trusting in Jesus, that two questions would be raised. The first question would be, how? How do we receive the blessings from this better plan that God has given? How do we receive those blessings? And the second question would be, why? We'll come to that in a moment. How do we receive the blessings that come from this better plan? And the author gives us two commands that we need to follow through on if we're going to receive the blessings from the better plan that God has. The first command is found in chapter 12 and verse 1. It's on page 1008 of your Pew Bible. It says, "Let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." Let us run with endurance. That's the first command. But included in that command is, let us set aside every weight and every sin that closely clings to us. Now, the author uses the imagery of a runner in the Olympic Games. And to this day, runners in the Olympic Games decide that they need to have as little weight on their bodies as possible to run. In old days, they had one way of doing it. Today, there's an industry on trying to make the fabric of the cloth and the design of the clothing that runners wear so minuscule that there is little drag on the cloth and there's little weight to carry so that you can run faster and faster and faster. Lay aside every weight. And the author of Hebrews doesn't tell us this, but the way he's describing it, he says there's a great cloud of witnesses from the Old Testament, from every believer who's ever lived. There's a great cloud of witnesses as we're running this race and coming into the arena. They're applauding, they're leaning over, and they're clapping for us, and they're encouraging us on. How? By the life and the example they lived and the faith they had when they faced death. And as we're running this race, let us run the race that is set before us. Well, I thought Jesus ran the race, and we'll come to that in a moment. But we have a race to run, and the goal we have is that we are going to see the promise fulfilled of another country that we're going to live in. Is that not the goal we have? And we are going to exhibit the qualities and the characteristics of the kingdom that is to come. Is that not the goal we have? And so he says, lay aside every weight. And the weight isn't necessarily bad things. It could be good things. It's good to be responsible about fulfilling the responsibilities of your job, but if your job takes over all aspects of your life and Jesus is left out, it's a weight that you are carrying you need to get rid of. Don't say leave the job, reorganize your priorities. If relationships with other people are getting in the way of our relationship with Jesus, maybe we need to reorganize and rethink about the relationship and how that needs to change. If our financial portfolio is getting in the way of Jesus, maybe we need to look at how we need to cast aside, as the original says, cast aside every weight and every sin that clings. And it's interesting, it says sin that clings, not sins that cling. Because every sin, plural, behavior, attitude, actions, every sin has a root cause, and that root cause is that we're trying to live on our own apart from God and rebelling against God. And in this passage, and in this book of Hebrews, the constant theme has been, don't give up on Jesus, don't rebel against Jesus, keep Jesus close. Which brings us to our second command, keep your eyes on Jesus. Keep your eyes on Jesus. He says it in verse 2. Looking to Jesus. That word looking means gaze upon. Look into. Focus on. Keep it there. Do you get the picture? Keeping your eyes on Jesus. Looking to Jesus. Why do we look to Jesus? Because he's the founder and perfecter of our faith. Or as one translation puts it, he's the pioneer. It means he's the one that blazes the trail. If you're out in the woods and there's no pathway, you need someone to cut down the lumber and the weeds ahead of you. And they blaze the trail so that you can come through. That's the picture that's here. He is the founder. He's the one that blazed the trail for us. He died for us. He rose for us. We cannot live this Christian life apart from him. Keep your eyes on Jesus. But not only is he the founder, the one who blazed the trail, he's the perfecter of our faith. He's the one that gives us the gift of faith through his Spirit that enables us to live for him the way we should. Keep your eyes on Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. And as we talked about this part last week, he became the founder of our faith because, as it says in verse 3, he who for the joy that was set before him, not the joy of the cross, but the joy of the salvation that the cross and resurrection would provide, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despised the shame. That word despise means treated the shame with disinterest. I need to learn that one better. When people say bad things about me, I don't always treat what they say with disinterest. I brood over it. I get mad about it. I dwell on it. What a concept. Being disinterested about the shame. And he's seated at the right hand of the throne of glory. Then it says, notice verse 3, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself. We're now coming to the why part of it. If I'm going to receive the blessings that come from a better plan that Jesus provides, why do I still have to face hostility from others? Why do I still have to face difficulties in my life? Why do I still have to face problems? Why do I still have to face, yes, even persecution if this is a better plan? Difficult times doesn't sound like a better plan, does it? And I want you to notice the example of Jesus. Jesus himself faced all of that and more. Because he says, notice what it says in verse 4. He says, you shouldn't grow weary or faint-hearted as you think about what you face. Look what Jesus faced. Then he asks a rhetorical question. Verse 4, in your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. I think the author is referring to the fact that when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane and he was praying, Father, not this cup, let this cup pass from me. It says it got to the point where the agony was so intense, the struggle was so deep that he began to sweat drops of blood. He says, have you gotten to that point yet in your struggle against sin? Have you gotten to that point yet in your difficulty with how people treat you? Have you gotten to that point yet where the problems of life cause you to sweat drops of blood? Of course not. And then he gives a reminder, verse 5. Have you not forgotten the exhortation? Have you not forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons and daughters? My children, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord. Do not be weary when reproved by him, for the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every child whom he receives. He says, you need to remember, God disciplines his children. Now the word discipline, we hear it, we often leap automatically over into punishment. We often leap automatically over to ouch. We leap automatically over to uncomfortable. But discipline, as Vince will tell you, who's been in the armed forces, discipline involves first training, and only after training has been given can punishment be given. Am I right? Pardon? Timely punishment. Is that what you said? Okay. I want you to notice. He said God disciplines you. He disciplines you because he loves you. He disciplines you as your son and daughter, not because of punishment, but just as parents train their children by bringing them up, giving them the direction, the teaching, the instruction that they need so that they can learn and grow and develop and become more mature and handle what comes at them through life. So God, our Father, disciplines us spiritually. It doesn't mean He takes away the temptations. It doesn't mean He takes away the heartache. It doesn't mean He takes away some of the results of sin we all experience because we live in a world of sin. It simply means He uses those things which He may not have caused to teach us discipline, to train us. And when you read through chapter 12, verses 4 through 17, you will discover a variety of ways in which God is using things that are not good and not healthy to train us, to discipline us. He uses temptations to things that hurt us. He uses difficult times such as persecution. He uses things like people saying bad things against us. And He says, if your earthly fathers disciplined you, how much more? Even though they didn't have the perfect plan of discipline, even though they even allowed their emotions to come up in their discipline, even though they had failures in how they gave discipline, including punishment. He says, if earthly fathers wanted to train you, how much more should you allow God to discipline you and train you through His Word, through prayer, through other Christians, through worship? And yes, even through failures that we experience. Comes to verse 12. After talking about the discipline, and knowing that this is a group of people he's writing to who have gotten to the point where they're so discouraged, they're about to give up, he says, therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be put out of joint but rather be healed. Notice he says, listen, lift up your weak hands. What's interesting is that phrase is used in Deuteronomy. It was used when the children of Israel said, as they were about to enter the promise, take us back to Egypt, it's too hard. The weak knees is a symbol of someone who can't stand on their own. They're about to collapse. He says, make a straight path to go to that place which you need to go, that place where Jesus is, so that you can find healing and strength to move forward in your Christian experience as God has disciplined you and trained you and you've come under His training. He says, and as you do that, strive for peace with everyone. And then he tells us what this discipline is to lead to. Notice what he says. Strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to that no one fails to obtain grace of God, that you don't have a root of bitterness that springs up. See to it that you're not immoral. See to it that you're not unholy like Esau, who looked at his birthright and said, I'll give my birthright away for tomorrow because I want a pot of some soup for today. I want you to notice what he's saying. The purpose of training is to lead us to be holy as he is holy through his righteousness, not our own. The purpose of training is so that we will not lose our grip on the grace of God. We will not fail to obtain the grace of God. It's interesting, he put the fact that we need to be holy, and then he talked about the grace of God. Why is that? Because if you talk about being holy without mentioning the grace of God, we will all fail. Because the grace of God enables us to be transformed by His power and grace, and the grace of God also provides forgiveness when we fail. And he goes on. He said, we can receive the blessing that Esau rejected. Because he was focused on the present and not on the future. After giving the reminder that we're to be disciplined, the good news comes in that we are enabled to receive an unshakable kingdom. Now, when you first read this, you kind of scratch your head, this next part, verses 18 to 29, you scratch your head and say, what's that all about? I'm not going to read the entire section, but what's interesting is that the author compares and contrasts what took place at Sinai with what takes place on Mount Zion, the New Jerusalem. And I want you to remember, what took place on Mount Sinai was that God appeared there, and when God appeared, there was thundering, there was lightning, the ground shook, there was an earthquake, there was a trumpet sound, and the voice of God thundered. And what was the reaction of the people? They drew back in fear. They were told they couldn't even touch the mountain. The warning was, stay away. Don't get close. But the author of Hebrews reminds us of the difference. The difference is, on Mount Zion, we're called to draw near. Through the grace of God that is provided through what Jesus accomplished, the blessings and the plan of salvation that that's been put into place, we're invited to draw near and to be in His presence. Reread the first part of Revelation 21 this afternoon. Notice that the invitation of Revelation 21, the threat of Revelation 21, is not come to heaven so that you can have a terrific place to live in. The threat in Revelation 21 is, I will be their God and they will be my people. The threat in Revelation 21 is, I will draw near to them and they will be with me. Numerous times in Revelation 21, speaking about heaven and the time when God will wipe away every tear from our eye, He mentions over and over and over again, I will be their God and they will be my people. That's what He's calling us to. I want you to notice what He says. When He says, we're called to the assembly in verse 23 of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven. How are you enrolled in heaven? When you think about signing up for school, you sign on the dotted line saying, I'm going to go. If you're signing to go to a college, you're saying, I'm going to go. And you're wondering how you're going to pay for it. We were enrolled in heaven, and we wondered how we're going to go, but the price has been paid to make it possible for us. You've all been given a free ride. I want you to notice what it says. He says, we've been called to the assembly of the firstborn who were enrolled in heaven, and we've been called to be with God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect. Don't get thrown off by that. It's referring back to what happened in verse 1 when he said we're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. These righteous people that God has followed God and believed in God and were faithful to death, their life and their example is that which speaks to us today. And he says we've been enrolled in heaven and called to Jesus by Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant. Because of the sprinkled blood that is better than the blood of Abel. And I scratched my head, what's that all about? And then I remembered, the blood of Abel cried out for vengeance. The blood of Jesus cries out for atonement. The blood of Abel said, wrong has been done. The blood of Jesus cries out, righteousness has overcome. And then comes this description, verse 25 through 29. See that you do not refuse him who is speaking. For if they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, talking about Moses, much less will we escape if we reject him who warns from heaven. And it talks about the fact that God is a consuming fire, and it warns us. It says, listen, you must listen to him. And I notice what it says in verse 26. He says, at that time, his voice shook the earth. Now he promised one more time. In other words, I'm going to do an even greater act in which I will shake not only the earth, but I will also shake the heavens. He's talking about the second coming. Everything that's been made will be shaken in order for the purpose that it cannot be shaken again. It's the promise that sin will not ever be here to bother us. It's the promise that God, when He speaks the second time, He will shake heaven and earth to the point that sin will be shaken out. Isn't that good news this morning? And then he says, therefore, as we think about belonging to this kingdom that cannot be shaken, what should we do? Let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. Let's admit it. All too often, we've lost our sense and purpose for what worship is or should be. And all too often, we've lost our sense of reverence and awe because we've made God more a friend than we have a mighty, powerful God. And we need both. We need both. I want you to reread those verses. When you come Sabbath morning, because Jesus has a better plan where you've received the blessings he offers, and if you are willing to be trained by him, are you willing to come with praise and offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe for who he is and what he has done? And allow God to consume the dross in your life that he can refine you as he trains you to reflect his character and his likeness. I want to ask you a question. I want to ask you a question about today. Today, are you willing? Do you want to receive the blessings that only God can give? That only God can give. Do you want to receive the blessings that only God can give, or do you want to try and forge your own blessings? I want to ask you a question. Where is your focus as you live your life? Is your focus on Jesus? Is it on yourself? Is it on others? Is it on a doctrine? Where's your focus? And secondly, are you willing to be trained by God using the problems and disappointments and heartaches and suffering and pain of this life, letting him use those to train you to become the person he created you to be? Finally, I want to ask you one more question. Are you looking forward to belonging to that unshakable kingdom that God has prepared for you?